You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this episode is presented by Rosalind English.
Hello, LawPod listeners. Today's subject is animals as legal subjects. Non-human animals lack agency. They're not legal entities. They are mere possessions like furniture. Of course, there are laws around that stop us trashing them like furniture. But how well those laws are enforced is a big question. Another challenge is the purpose for which these animals are kept. We love our companion animals, our cats and our dogs, almost as much as we love our children. But pigs, which have been found recently to have the same level of intelligence as dogs, are food animals, and we don't like to think about them too much. And of course, there are animals kept for the purposes of scientific research, and that's a minefield. This country recently passed the Animal Sentience Act, which is meant to put due regard for animal welfare at the centre of policy making. Well, easier said than done. I have with me solicitor Edie Bowles of the Animal Law Foundation. This is a legal research charity that looks into neglected areas of animal law. Joining Edie is Dr. Rachel Dunn of Leeds Beckett University. She's well versed in the reach of the Animal Sentience Act and the way it intersects with other legislation such as the Animal Welfare Act 2006. Starting with you, Rachel, you and Joshua Jart of Newcastle University wrote a chapter in a book, Evolution or Revolution in the Recognition of Animal Sentience. What does this act cover and why was it brought into place?
The main reason that it was brought in was due to our departure from the EU through Brexit. So prior to the Sentience Act, animal sentience had been recognised in Article 13 of the Treaty of the Functioning of the European Union. And when we were leaving the EU, we were deciding which bits to keep and which bits to get rid of. That was one of the things that was decided we wouldn't retain. And there was quite understandably a lot of public uproar about that. A lot of animal NGOs were not happy with that decision because it sends a strong message that we take the suffering and the protection of animals seriously. But the government made it clear that the reason that they didn't want to retain it is because they wanted to do something different. And actually what they have done is quite different to other places in the world, that they haven't just recognised sentience, which the Act doesn't necessarily explicitly do. They have established the Animal Sentience Committee. So a committee that is dedicated to looking at policy and deciding whether ministers have paid due regard to the welfare of animals as sentient beings. So that's the main reason why the Act came into force.
So we've obviously got a lot to cover here, because although it's a very, very short act, it is doing something potentially very ambitious, which is moving animal welfare from a rights-based system to a kind of, well, a central government policy-based system. Can we talk first, I mean, either of you, Rachel or Edie, you can jump in, about what animals are considered sentient as opposed to those non-human animals that are not part of the Act's coverage?
Yeah, I'll go first, Edie, and then you can add to it if you want. So the Act was quite progressive in some ways in that it has recognised animals as sentient that haven't been previously recognised. So under the Animal Welfare Act, it's only vertebrates other than man that are protected within the Animal Welfare Act. Whereas in the Animal Sentience Act, there was an amazing work done by Jonathan Birch and his team at LSE on cephalopod mollusks and decapod crustaceans. And they've evidenced sentience of certain species that have made their way into the Animal Sentience Act. So thinking about animals like octopuses and lobsters are now recognised as sentient beings. one of the issues with that, which ED's been doing some work around recently, is that even though they're recognised as sentients under the Act, that protection hasn't appeared anywhere else. So there hasn't been an amendment to the Animal Welfare Act to include them within that Act. So we still get a lot of practices like the live boiling of lobsters in restaurants and in people's homes, for example. So it's great that they're recognised in the Sentience Act, along with all other vertebrates other than man, but how much that has actually extended their protection in practice is still really to be determined.
Yeah, thank you. And I'll just add to that, Rachel. Thanks for that very clear explanation. So Rachel's correct in terms of the animals that are protected under the Sentience Act. However, I'm slightly more optimistic than Rachel that they do change current legal protections for decapod crustaceans. So invertebrates actually are protected under the Welfare of Animals at the Time of Killing regulations. They're protected from avoidable pain and suffering at the time of killing. Now, prior to the Sentience Act, it would have been very easy to simply argue that these animals didn't feel pain. And so as a result of that, it'd be very difficult to bring a criminal prosecution. However, as soon as they got recognised as sentient, we strongly believe at the Animal Law Foundation that that does render certain killing practices as unlawful if it is causing avoidable pain and suffering. And we have had a lot of positive indications that there is a move towards this, that there is an acceptance that our interpretation is in fact correct. So that will stand regardless of whether they're included in the Animal Welfare Act or not. So as things currently stand, there is a really strong argument that it's currently unlawful to boil lobsters alive. And that is thanks to the recognition under the Sentience Act, albeit probably something that was potentially, you know, or possibly unintended. But either way, there is now a clear recognition that they experience pain, which has activated that legal provision.
I think I can always be a little bit more pessimistic when it comes to some of the animal welfare legislation that we get coming through, which I think we'll talk about some of the reasons why during the remainder of this podcast. It is amazing that these animals have been recognised as sentient, and there's been a lot of research that has gone into, you know, it's only really since the 90s that research into octopuses really took off and was taken as a serious subject. So it is a big step forward that they are recognised as sentient beings. And like Edie said, it can help to push forward agendas to further their protection.
Okay, well, we've got a broad picture of what the Animal Sentience Act, together with the Animal Welfare Act, covers. Now, that's one area. The real challenge lies in compliance and enforceability. Now, who's responsible for making sure that due regard is paid in practice, not just in terms of formulating policy?
Great question. So it depends on the animal in question. But primarily, it would tend to be the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs that tends to be the central authority in charge of most animal protection legislation. However, a lot of the enforcement responsibilities have been delegated to local authorities. So it's a bit of a split role. There's also various other actors involved, such as the Food Standards Authority and Food Standards Scotland when it comes to enforcement in slaughterhouses. But central regulation tends to rest with DEFRA.
The answer that most people would give, if you stopped them in the street to ask them, who do you think is responsible for prosecuting cases of animal cruelty, would of course be the RSPCA. But the RSPCA is, after all, only a charity. It can't be everywhere at all times. And I have read somewhere in the literature that, in fact, they've been very successful bringing prosecutions. 90% of the cases which were called for prosecutions are brought by the RSPCA. But they're stretched. And they have now turned to the Crown Prosecution Service, have they not, to take on some of the responsibility that they've been carrying out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I completely share your concern with what you said. You know, they're a charity. And I actually think that the fact that it has been left to them for so long to prosecute these cases is indicative of the enforcement problem more broadly, which is how animal law is viewed. The fact that you've handed over responsibility to a charity really, really illustrates that. So, of course, you know, of course, it's brilliant that there is the right to private prosecution, which is what the RSPCA relies on. They don't have any legislative authority to be bringing these prosecutions. They rely on a right that we all have, which is incredibly important, and it's an important safeguard, especially, you know, when dealing with vulnerable situations like animals. However, you do want to see the public bodies taking it seriously, and absolutely they should be, and primarily should be the ones bringing these cases. But you are correct that there has been a move towards handing this prosecution role back to public bodies.
How do you see that that's going to be taken up by the central authorities? I mean, are you optimistic about it, either of you?
In theory, with adequate resources, yes. It certainly should be with them. Of course, there are concerns. The concern is that they don't necessarily have the right expertise yet. You know, the RSPCA has specialised in this area for so long that they've built up a real understanding of the legislation, of what's needed to kind of prove these cases. So, yeah, there are concerns with handing that role over. And of course, resources, you know, I say that almost in passing, but it's a huge issue. And in fact, one of the reasons why there is an enforcement problem more broadly at a local authority level, at a central authority level, is to do with a lack of resources. So that is a serious issue that will need to be addressed to ensure that the laws can be adequately enforced by the public bodies.
Let's just have a look at farmed animals, because just the sheer number is really what makes them a problem, but also something that we should really, really be addressing and thinking about, although we don't really want to. What is the status of a farm in this framework of animal welfare legislation? What is a farm? What kind of entity is it?
I mean, that's a huge question.
Yes.
I mean, different kind of legislative frameworks, I imagine, will address that very, very differently. But for the purpose of animal welfare, currently there is no kind of authorization process needed to keep animals. So in fact, there's a looseness around that. And actually something that really illustrates that is when gathering our data to show that there was an enforcement problem, to look at, you know, how many farms were inspected, how much non-compliance was detected, how many enforcement actions were brought. One of the things that we realised is actually different public bodies have a different number of farms recorded. So that question actually kind of illustrates a problem, which is we don't even know the answer to that. We don't even know how many kind of these entities keeping these animals for commercial purposes exist. So what constitutes a farm? I imagine there's a degree of common sense to it. Well, actually, perhaps there isn't, because of course there's farms that keep animals for personal kind of use and consumption, and farms that are obviously for more, you know, wider commercial purposes. So there are obviously kind of different types of farms that exist out there. But let's, for the sake of this conversation, assume that we're talking about an entity that keeps farmed animals for, you know, so animals that are used for human consumption and, you know, the keeping of those animals for commercial purposes.
And of course, going back to the Animal Sentience Act and the committee that's appointed to make decisions under it, they're the ones who will look at the codes of practice generated by the farming industry and determine that they're in accordance with animal welfare legislation. Have I got that right? Is that how it works?
I mean, yes, they could potentially review them, but their purpose is to review policy. So I suppose it depends on whether or not they want to spend the time reviewing that and what policy that would necessarily link to. I think this is one of the issues, particularly with farming, for the Animal Sentience Committee, that they have such a wide remit that all of the policy going through that could potentially impact on the welfare of animals as sentient beings is really quite wide. So it could be something that they decide to look at, but it would depend on the policy that links to and whether or not they want to.
Yeah, and primarily the people that would be ensuring the enforcement of those codes and regulations would be the local authorities. And of course, they are directed to the keepers themselves. They're essentially, you know, guidance to comply with the legislation. So the primary responsibility will rest with the keeper. And then it's for the enforcement agency to make sure that they are compliant.
And do we think that these codes of practice and the compliance patterns that follow are keeping up with the scientific understanding of how animals are conscious, sentient, have both emotional and physical, and I wouldn't say intellectual, but thinking lives to consider?
Another big question, isn't it, really, Edie?
They're all big questions.
They are.
Yeah.
I think they try to on paper, but in practice, trying to enforce that is a very different matter, which ED has obviously experienced lately in some of the cases that she's been bringing on behalf of fast-grown chickens. So I think there is the aim that it keeps up with science, but whether or not what we understand from the science kind of plays through into enforcement and into the courtroom is a different issue, really.
Yeah, I imagine that the answer to that is probably not. There's a huge lack of guidance with a lot of practices that we know cause suffering. One example, obviously, being the boiling of lobsters alive at the time of killing, something that is now kind of officially recognised but hasn't made its way over to a code of practice that's directed at the people conducting this activity and those responsible for enforcing the legislation. Similarly, another case I'm involved in is to do with the handling practices of chickens, namely handling them upside down by their legs, something which is universally recognised as causing suffering for various reasons. Chickens don't have a diaphragm, so it causes breathing difficulties. It also causes leg breakages and various other welfare issues. Yet that practice is endorsed in the code of practice for chickens kept for meat and chickens kept for eggs. So again, another example of it not keeping up with scientific knowledge. But Rachel's absolutely right. There is that intention to do so. And of course, at the heart of the Animal Welfare Act is an intention to keep up with scientific knowledge. Yet the reality is it doesn't appear to.
You actually mentioned these two particular details about the management of farm animals. I mean, there is a council of despair, which is when you've got millions and millions of chickens fast growing in intense broiler houses and laying facilities. You're quibbling about a detail here. I mean, how they're carried when the whole thing is so appalling and monstrous. But we won't go there. Let's not go there. What I really wanted to ask you is, when your charity formulates a particular legal challenge, let's take the handling of chickens, for example, how do you go about it? What particular legal basis do you find to launch, for example, judicial review proceedings?
Yeah, great question. And to be honest, it does kind of play into what you just said, to be honest. We obviously deal with the legislation as it exists, and that's always our starting point. And whilst it is just kind of one element of a practice, you know, chicken farming has a lot of welfare issues attached to it. And of course, handling is just one very small aspect of that. It still is an incredibly stressful practice. It still does involve a lot of death, actually, of the chickens throughout that process. And it's just a horrible way to end their lives. You know, that's the only time they're handled, when they're, you know, being picked up to be taken to the slaughterhouse. And that whole process is incredibly stressful. So whilst it's obviously limited to one aspect of their life, by getting that protection enforced, you are improving a moment, you know, for a billion chickens per year. You know, that's how many are farmed in the UK. So it is important to ensure that these laws mean something in practice, even if they're just one part of an otherwise bigger problem. And we choose our cases based on what the legislation says and comparing it to what we see in practice. You know, we make sure that all of our cases are robust, credible. You know, we want to win these cases. We want to ensure that the laws that exist to protect animals mean something in practice. You know, of course, that's what the public think when this legislation goes through Parliament. And that's what the public think when they claim that, you know, we're a nation of animal lovers and that we have some of the highest standards in the world. That would be great. But the reality is we see this legislation mean little in practice when it's not enforced and when it's interpreted in a way that's allowing what we would argue are illegal practices, like the handling of chickens.
The other campaign I just wanted to touch on of yours was docking of pigs' tails. Why is that even done?
Really great question as well, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk about it, because it is one of those things that's indicative of a wider problem. So pigs are incredibly intelligent, as you said at the start of this podcast. And as a result of that, the environments that they're kept in creates serious issues, such as boredom. They tend to be very barren environments with not much to do. Whilst enrichment is meant to be provided, it's often far from adequate and absolutely cannot cater to the complex needs of these very, very intelligent animals. So as a result of that, they tend to resort to biting each other. And so tails tend to be docked to respond to that. But of course, it's dealing with the symptom rather than the root cause. And then again, just kind of coming back to, you know, we want the law to mean something. There is actually a law that protects pigs from routine tail docking, yet tail docking happens in 85% of cases on farms up and down the country. So you have this one law that says you're not allowed to routinely dock pigtails, and yet 85% are being docked. Clearly something has gone wrong. And it is clearly to do with just the commercial realities, I suppose, that it's easier to just get rid of that issue, because obviously tails are easy to bite, you know, amongst each other. But again, we want the laws to mean something in practice. And if it is a case that the environment is causing this, then deal with the environment. Don't dilute the limited legal protections that exist.
So what you're saying, what I hear you saying, is that it's illegal. Docking of 87% of pigs' tails is illegal because the law says the routine docking is not allowed. Who should be prosecuting this?
So again, local authorities, but of course it will be taken case by case. And in fact, we find a very interesting part of this puzzle being the fact that vets authorise the tail docking. So we're very keen to understand the role that they play in this systemic problem, I suppose. So yeah, the issue is it's obviously case by case as to whether you'd be successful bringing a prosecution. But of course, that 85% does indicate that there is a system-wide problem, that there is routine tail docking going on. But of course, when it comes to the prosecution level, it would have to be farm by farm.
Rachel, do you see that we seem to be perpetuating this problem, that we might be relying on charities, not just the RSPCA, but charities like EDs, to do the job that central authorities should be doing?
Yeah, and that's not uncommon in England and Wales. There's many countries across the world where there's a great reliance on NGOs to enforce and investigate animal welfare issues. Some of them are given statutory powers, which can help with that. And obviously they can get a bit more resourcing towards that. But a lot of the time it is the system that we have here, where there's a lot of charities and NGOs that take the brunt of that work. And it often feels as though the government allows for that to happen because they are used to that system where charities and NGOs will step in and do this really vital work. They don't provide extra funding to local authorities to help with the investigation and enforcement under the Animal Welfare Act. And whilst it's not excusable, it's understandable why local authorities potentially don't do as much as they should be doing, because their resources are just as, you know, depleting as other areas and other businesses and public services are across the country really at the moment. So it's not necessarily surprising, but really if we do want that to change, the government needs to put more funding into animal welfare investigation and enforcement.
This is a very tricky era. Some people saying this country is going into recession if we aren't in one already. This is very low down on a lot of people's priorities. I just wanted to touch on this country's relationship with the EU. I remember that during and after the Brexit campaign, leaving the European Union was repeatedly framed as an opportunity to strengthen the United Kingdom's animal welfare standards. And I mean, I, for one, was rather hoping that the removal of the third pillar of the European Union, free movement of goods, because animals, of course, are goods, and the transport of live animals would come to an end. Where are we with that now? It's been years since we left the Union. Where are we?
You're right. That was one of the kind of platforms that was campaigned on when the Brexit campaign took place. So potentially was one of the positive things that would happen when leaving the EU. However, there are risks that it doesn't look like it's going to go that way. Just to give you one example, handling chickens by their legs is actually an EU-derived piece of legislation. So the EU prohibits the carrying of animals by their legs during transport-related operations. And like I said, that's the only time a chicken would be handled. Obviously, there'd be some rare exceptions, but that tends to be the only time that they're handled. The EU prohibits that. We've obviously retained that piece of legislation. Yet, following the threat from the Animal Law Foundation, we've now actually issued proceedings, but following the threat from the Animal Law Foundation, the government, rather than addressing the enforcement issue, have recently opened a consultation to dilute the law, to change the law to allow for the handling of chickens by their legs, which would be the first dilution of an EU animal welfare standard. So, of course, not only did they campaign that they would improve animal welfare, they also reassured us that they wouldn't dilute animal welfare. And here we have a situation where it does look like an EU-derived standard is going to be diluted.
That's quite depressing. Do you both think that there's just going to be a race to the bottom? I'm particularly thinking of farming because farming's about food and food is an emotional electoral issue, particularly the cost of food. Is this a bleak picture that we're painting and looking at?
Well, I think farming is always a bit of a bleak picture. That's how I feel anyway. It's one of the biggest ways that we use animals in the world is for food. And though we have protections for them, they are very hard to enforce because a lot of the time that commercial interest, that economic interest of those animals will outweigh their welfare. So there's always this fine balancing act within the legal system of where we're trying to be proportionate with these animals that doesn't always necessarily come out in their favour. It's a difficult one to know. Obviously, there are issues with farming for the farmers as well. They're under increasing pressures. And that is a big government concern at the moment to try and help them through these periods, particularly after Brexit. Whether we are on a race to the bottom, it's kind of difficult to know what the bottom would be, I think, in some respects. I think one of the big issues that frustrates me, that gets forgotten a lot, is that we think about farmed animals and we think, you know, they're very much hidden from the public eye. We don't see those animals until they hit the shelves on the supermarket. But the issues that farmed animals face can directly feed into issues that humans face. So actually, these issues are also human issues a lot of the time in terms of thinking about pollution, particularly for people that are living close to intensive farms. When we think about diseases that can be spread among farms and transfer into the food system. So the government is very concerned with aspects in terms of food security, and that's been quite apparent for the last few years, particularly, you know, seeing things like the rise of avian flu that can have an impact on our food security and our food systems. So in some ways, there does seem to be quite a bit of care around it. But when we think about caring for the animals, say, in themselves, that they should be protected from suffering and that they are sentient beings, we're maybe slipping with that a little bit more.
Sure. Edie, have you got thoughts on this?
The frustrating thing is I think people all over the world care about animal welfare. You know, we do some work in other countries as well. And certainly I have colleagues in other countries practicing as animal lawyers there. And yeah, I think people care about animals the world over. Yet for some reason, that's not really reflected in legislation and in trade deals. And so the risk of a race to the bottom is to do with international trade, which, where, you know, it runs the risk of countries not wanting to put their standards too high due to imports, essentially. And like I say, it's frustrating because the country that they're importing from, the population probably also care about animals. So I suppose the positive thing to take from that is that if we can have some sort of kind of global conversation about animal welfare, I feel like we could probably address the issues. But yeah, there are serious risks with trading.
It feels to me like that global conversation is going to be even more difficult than climate change. I was going to ask you about labelling. In fact, I will ask you about labelling because that is one of your campaigns. It's a subject unto itself. It's huge. People care about animals, or some people do. And when I go shopping, I pick up a packet of chicken or meat, or whatever, and it says it's higher welfare, or it's farm assured, or it's red tracted. What do they mean? Do you think that we need to address the communication to the consumers in a way that is far more honest than it is at the moment?
I would say yes. I mean, obviously, Edie is more of the expert on this. I think one of the issues with labels like red tractor is farmers pay to be in those schemes. Right. So then you've got this issue of farms paying to have that badge on their food so people can go, yep, they're a good ethical farm. But then that generates a business for these labelling companies. So they need these farmers to pass so that they can pay. I'm not saying that this is what is always happening, but there is obviously an issue there with when you're relying on that income stream you're not going to be taking it away unless it's absolutely necessary so that you can continue to receive those payments. And that is one of the issues that has been seen with some of these labelling schemes. And obviously then that feeds into the public and they don't know who to trust. So, you know, there's a few case studies that have been on the media recently and people just don't quite know who to trust when it comes to labelling and what it means a lot of the time as well, because the labelling can look good, but actually it's pretty much at standard or just above the welfare standards that we would set anyway, which, as we've already talked about, aren't always great in practice. So what consumers think they're buying isn't necessarily always what they think they are getting.
Edie, can you expand on the Animal Law Foundation's campaign regarding this kind of information or misinformation?
Yeah, I mean, misinformation, to be honest. Yeah, so there's a huge problem with misinformation within the food supply chain. It's everywhere, and it's not always with kind of sinister intentions behind it, you know, but it's on TV shows. The dominant image that people have of UK farming is a happy image with healthy animals outside. That's just not the reality. The majority of animals are farmed inside. The dominant farming industry that we have in this country is the industrial farming model. And the problem is the image that people have in their mind is so far away from the reality. So actually, even regardless of labelling or food advertising, in many ways, the pictures out there, the storybooks you read as a child, are doing the bidding for the marketers, for the sellers. So we do have a real problem because, again, like coming back to what I said, I do think that people care about animals. And I do think that if people were more aware of the reality, they would make different purchasing decisions. And that fact is very problematic. I mean, it's hard to reconcile that with the consumer protection legislation that exists. You know, if consumer protection legislation is all about protecting consumers with their purchasing decisions, providing, you know, the right information, and we have such a complicated tapestry when it comes to the image of UK farming that it's hard to kind of untangle that, you know, for that kind of consumer protection position. But something needs to be done, and labelling is definitely one of those solutions that could be used to help with that. And kind of going back to what we were saying earlier about enforcement being left to the RSPCA, in many ways the same thing happens here. Labelling should not be left to private players. It should be standardised, it should be official, and the consumer should know what each label means. You know, more information can only be a good thing, and people deserve to know. People have the right to know. So there are some labelling requirements for fish products and for egg products to label the method of production. And we saw that when egg labelling, method of production labelling was introduced, the sale of free-range eggs went up by 43%. So when consumers are given that information, they tend to make the decisions that kind of align with what they believe. So I think it can only be a good thing, and it's absolutely something that's long overdue. And it is kind of very, very strange that it doesn't exist already, to be honest.
Yeah, I think independence is key when it comes to labelling, as Edie said. It just feels like NGOs and charities a lot of the time are plugging the gap that actually should be coming from more authoritative places with the resources to ensure that it is being done to the highest standard possible.
Well, on that note, I think we'd better wrap it up. As it were. Labelling is something we can do something about, so that's an optimistic note on which to leave it. Well done for all your work with the Animal Law Foundation. All power to you, Edie. And Rachel, thank you so much for bringing your expertise to bear on this subject. There's more to be gone into. Obviously, we've only touched on some of the big subjects. Fish farming, that's another whole area. But yes, thank you very much for coming on to LawPod UK, both of you. And hopefully next time we meet, there'll be slightly better developments in law and practice we can discuss.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Rosalind English. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row